Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. I am joined today by Tim Matthews to discuss Storm of the Century. Before we dive in, I want to let you know that we will be discussing the screenplay and the actual TV miniseries because this was one of the few things where I have found that the screenplay was actually officially released for it right around the same time the show was coming out. I have managed to pick up screenplays for The Green Mile and Shawshank Redemption, I believe, and it does seem to be few and far between given the large amount of Stephen King adaptations, wouldn't you agree, Tim?
Yeah. It was funny reading the introduction to it and Stephen King talking about how he basically was being shown dailies and he was really stoked on what he was seeing. So it was interesting that his perspective in writing the introduction, he hadn't even seen the adaptation yet. It was still in the works. So that was entertaining to read. A really long introduction, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised by Stephen King.
Yeah, so I want to dive into the screenplay first a little bit without giving away any of the story, because we'll definitely talk about that when we talk about the actual series. But as far as the screenplay goes, this seemed way more detailed than I expected. And with you being someone who is involved in the film world, I just kind of wanted to get your perspective on whether or not this felt like the screenplay was almost too detailed.
Simple answer. As a screenplay, yes. I do think it's too detailed. And I mean, I could be wrong, but at least the large amount of screenplays I've read and when I was in school and learning to write a screenplay, you did not go so in depth of camera pans and things like that. And there's detailed character motivation throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And description of their facial expressions, kind of giving direction to an actor. And I feel like that's generally not in the screenplay.
That comes from the director more often than not.
Right. And leaves some interpretation for the actor and the director to work with. How are we portraying these lines? It made for a very, very fun and unique read because it feels like you're reading a Stephen King novel that also happens to be in screenplay form, because it's when you get into those deep descriptions and everything, and and at times pages go on without any dialogue. And I felt like I was just reading a Stephen King book, and then it would break it up when you'd get to the dialogue. But what also was interesting was that while reading those super descriptive portions, and it felt like I was reading a Stephen King book, it also kind of felt like a first draft of a Stephen King book.
Uh-huh.
Because some of the descriptions, when he would just describe how someone looked or something, it just felt kind of like an offhanded note that he would possibly jot on just the margins of the page and not necessarily put in the actual book.
Or his character list or something, which I believe he keeps some of those when he writes. And you're kind of oh, okay, these descriptions are so detailed that it was almost like everyone was cast beforehand, because you're wait, what? How is he describing these characters in such immense detail? And even all of the actions and the settings, it was just like reading one of his books. And I mentioned having the Shawshank and Green Mile screenplays, and those are half the size of this one. Granted, I know those are feature films versus a TV miniseries, but when I saw how detailed the screenplay was for Storm of the Century, I was like, is this going to be 6 hours long? And you know what? It was long.
Yeah, what did it come out to? 4 hours, I think?
Yeah, so basically it did air over 6 hours, but with commercials, it got cut down to about four and a half hours, somewhere like that.
Okay. Yeah, the version I watched, I unfortunately have to say I broke my rule and I watched it on YouTube. It was funny because I watched it on YouTube because I found it was actually a pretty decent quality, because I told you, I was looking for the DVD online.
It's so expensive.
Yeah. But then this afternoon, I glanced at a few on eBay, and they were used, but, they were $10. And I was crap, I should have just gotten that. But who knows, maybe, you know, Scream Factory or someone will come out and with a, you know, a nice Blu-ray re-release or something. I don't know when it was written, but I think it was on Screen Rant or Slash Film, one of those. And they were just talking about how this is kind of, it's decently well regarded as a Stephen King miniseries and is apparently one of Stephen King's like favorite miniseries that were produced out of his work. Yet they were talking about how it oddly isn't as often in the conversation as, say, The Stand or It, or, you know, some of the other TV miniseries. And mm-hmm. I wonder if that's just because the DVD is so difficult to find, or I don't know. Because, I mean, it came out in 1999, so it's, I mean, it's old, but
it's not that old.
Yeah, about the same as the majority of the others.
Yeah, I think because this was something he wrote strictly for TV, maybe it wasn't something that people immediately associated with him, even though obviously his name appears in the credits and you always get a sense of what he himself is doing, because I imagine back then it still would have been promoted maybe in some way by his publicist or something, because I look at my copies of the books that I have and it's like, oh, the next one's coming. So it's like when one thing publishes, they already know what he's working on next. And yeah, it's not really ever a surprise to anyone what he's working on at any given moment. Granted, I was not reading or watching Stephen King in 1999 because I turned 7 at the end of 1999. So I didn't even know this existed until I went and made the spreadsheet for this podcast. So I think it could just be one of those things where it was on TV and whoever had the rights to it, the production company or whatever, whoever aired it, they just never really did anything with the home video beyond making one DVD. It's not like you said, It or anything else where you can get a lot of the big adaptations on Blu-ray now. That sort of tells me how big some of these adaptations have or haven't been, because if you can't find it on Blu-ray, it's probably going to be very hard to find in general. And if you can't find it on digital, then you know it's even harder to find.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't believe I was reading Stephen King in 1999, but I was actively watching Stephen King in 1999. As I'm sure I've mentioned before on this podcast, my dad got me into Stephen King. I found it recently, the VHS of Salem's Lot. It would sit on the shelf and I would just look at the cover and I was just fascinated by it. And I'm like, this is so cool. And I just remember being young and my dad being like, you're not old enough. Then finally I was old enough and we watched it and I was like, this is great. And then he tricked me into watching It, knowing that I was terrified of clowns because of Poltergeist. And that was funny for him, not so much for me. But I remember Storm of the Century coming out. I remember it being a huge deal. It was a TV event. You know, people were going to be home to watch it. You know, it wasn't, we had a VCR. I think some people had TiVos and stuff. Maybe, I'm not sure when that was a thing, but we had a VCR and we were recording it, but it was, we got to get home. We got to watch it. It's going to be awesome. And we sat, we watched the whole thing. And I remember as a kid just being blown away by it. And it was funny because I haven't seen it probably since then, or maybe watched it once in between. And sitting and reading the screenplay before watching it, like a lot of the imagery came back. And then it was fun to watch the miniseries and kind of see how accurate my nostalgic, you know, eyes remembered it. I had Linoja's voice not perfectly correct. I had it actually a lot different in my head. And then when he started talking out the first like 10 minutes, I was kind of disappointed. I was like, well, that's not how I've been hearing it in my head for like a week. But then it was great. It was cool to watch it in the moment. I remember it being a big deal. So it is unfortunate and kind of strange that people haven't possibly explored it as much since then.
Yeah. And why don't we go ahead and just dive right into the actual TV series portion of this discussion, because I feel like sometimes when you can't find something of Stephen King's, it's probably because it isn't fantastic and doesn't really warrant being reproduced in any way. But with this, I thought the TV miniseries was actually pretty good. I was sort of expecting, because of how hard it was to find, to have it just be some weird atrocity that, you know, you can get from time to time with just certain horror TV series and things like that. But from what I can tell, this actually had a pretty big budget. And you really get a sense that given the cast, this was something that was very 1999. So it was very of the time. But when you watch it,
yeah,
there isn't really anything that gives it away.
Right. I think the fact that it takes place in 1989, you don't get stuck with any super 90s technologies or anything that would really, really date it. You know, it's older, you know, but I feel like the fact that it's on kind of this like island, it's, you know, an old town, you know, maybe some of the fashion choices are decently 90s slash, you know, late 80s, really a lot of that blended together. But I felt like the way it was set and kind of how they kept away from very era specific technologies or from, you know, it not being in the 90s, I think allows it to kind of have this somewhat timeless tale to it, where it's as I was watching it, I wasn't sitting there and thinking, oh my God, this is super dated. I mean, some of the stuff with the special effects, obviously, and, you know, as I'm watching it, the way it's filmed made me feel like at times that I was watching like an X-Files episode. You know, it's all very, very structurally like that. But I love the X-Files, so I was totally into it. And Tim Daly being the star, I just finished rewatching Superman the Animated Series. It's Superman himself.
Yeah.
albeit with I think a good New England accent. I'm not sure.
I don't really know what a New England accent is supposed to sound like. So I was like, I don't know if this is good. So we're just going to go with it. And to your technology point, I think there was the fact that this storm was coming in. So either way, I think a storm would have knocked out any technology they would have thought to include, because a lot of it is using walkie-talkies, which, you know, walkie-talkies still get used today if you're in an area where there's no cell coverage and things like that. Because I know that a specific route that my parents would take from California to Colorado, they were like texting me, hey, we're going to hit the dead zone, so if you try to call, we can't answer or anything like that. So these things still exist.
Shout out to another Stephen King adaptation.
You really just don't know what to expect when a storm hits, I would imagine, still. And being on an island, they're really cut off from so many other things, because they talked about how some people made it out to the mainland and some people opted to stay on the island. And from what I can tell, anytime there's a storm in Maine, it's going to be pretty bad.
Yeah. And speaking of how bad, you know, the storms can be, I mean, that I thought how they portrayed it was really impressive. And Stephen King talked about that in writing the screenplay. Like, he kind of knew that he was going to be handing whatever network a kind of like, you know, network special effects nightmare, you know. And he even points out, like, without even getting into the fact that he's got, you know, these creepy red eyes and stuff like that, just the fact that it was going to have to be not just snow everywhere, but like insane blizzard and everything. And I thought it came off really well. It felt like a lived-in town. It didn't necessarily feel like a set.
Yeah, that's always fun when you really get a sense for what these towns feel like through the settings. And right off the bat, when you have the first death, you start to get a sense of who the characters are. And you have the young boy who finds this elderly woman murdered in her own house, and he's just running frantically down the street, as you imagine a lot of kids would, especially when it's such a small town where everyone seems to know everyone. And yeah, that is a very reasonable reaction. Whether or not it was acted super well is a different discussion. Yeah. But then you have, you know, just all your different plethora of characters within this small town. You have, like you mentioned, Tim Daly is Mike Anderson, who is a shop owner and the constable. So that's how small this town is. He makes a comment at some point like, you pay me $6,000 a year to be your constable, let me do my job. And I'm just like, that's not a lot of money. So clearly a town that isn't riddled with crime, and it's probably mostly him just dealing with drunks. So it looked like they basically had a drunk tank upstairs from the market or whatever, wherever it was. And then you have...
It's very like Andy Griffith.
And then you have Jeffrey DeMunn as Robbie Beals, who is the town manager. Whatever that means, I'm not really sure. But he is just the most annoying character.
Oh, yeah. And this that guy is, he's in everything. He's in everything. And I feel like this type of character is a lot of the time that you see him turn up. You know, him also sporting, you know, quite the New England accent. And I guess he's kind of the mayor. Like, I don't know. Like, he makes a comment to Mike of, you know, come the next town hall, we're going to have a change in the constable or whatever. And he's like, well, the next town hall's in March, it's February. He's like, so let me do my job until then. You know, it's, they clearly have issues in the power dynamic. I get the feeling that the people in the town definitely trust and look towards Mike's leadership above perhaps the people who have the technical leadership jobs in the town.
Yeah, and you really just feel like, okay, we're going to get to know a lot of these characters, and there are a lot of characters that they introduce you to throughout the four and a half hours of this, and it's almost a little too much to keep track of, because then you're like, wait, who is this one married to? Okay, this couple is together, and then this person's mother is just being very strange this whole time, and then you have all the children, and you're trying to keep track of who they belong to, and you really just get a sense that almost this entire small town comes together in one place, which ends up being, you know, the town hall, city hall, whatever they end up calling it in this, and it's clearly big enough to hold probably more people than it needs to, even though they had said some went to the mainland, because I'm sure if they live on that island, maybe they have family on the mainland or something like that. But either way, you really just get a sense that something is going to happen here that is going to tear this town apart more than it already has, just with daily events, because you can tell a lot of people don't like Robbie Beals. You can tell that a lot of people do like Mike Anderson, because he's the guy who is always trying to help people and just wants to live his life, run his store. And then you see his downward spiral, because you have him doing all of these things to help, and then it's like the whole town turns on him. Because basically Andre Lenoge comes and he is like, give me what I want and I'll leave. And it slowly reveals that he is some sort of demon who is dying, and he needs a protege that can basically live on in his honor, I guess, or something really weird. It felt a lot like Needful Things, when you get the shop owner who comes in from out of town and he just manipulates the entire town of Castle Rock into doing his bidding for him. And really, that's what Lenoge does too. He causes so much destruction that he slowly starts to get people to just do whatever he wants them to do.
Yeah. First of all, they get to the first death so quickly. And, you know, in terms of Stephen King stories, the whole thing is still like a slow burn of, you know, the horrors happening throughout. But the fact that they kind of like get to it right away, you know, he murders Martha, and, you know, he sits and he waits to be arrested. And one of the things that I loved is when they're in the shop and he takes Ralphie, and Ralphie asks him, he's like, you know, why are you wearing the handcuffs? He just says, because I choose to. And it reminded me of the scene in Man of Steel, when, you know, he agrees to go in and he's got the handcuffs, and Lois is like, you know, you could break out of those, and he says, you know, whatever makes them feel comfortable. But like, Lenoge's side of it is way more sinister. It's just like, I choose to. It's like, he knows it doesn't matter. He doesn't matter if he's bound, doesn't matter if they put him in the cell, and he sits there. And he just causes all this horror to happen. I guess through his mind, his magic. And the people in the town, clearly, you know, as you said, it's this, you know, quiet town. Everyone's really close. Clearly, nothing really atrocious happens in terms of murder. Even when the kid's like freaking out that Martha's been murdered, he's kind of like, kid's joking, like what the heck's going on, like people don't get murdered in this town. But little by little, each of these horrible things starts happening that Mike and all of them can't explain, and they're forced to just come to terms with this man is, he can't be human. You know, we don't know what he is, we don't know who he is, but he wants something, and he's clearly shown a power that we don't understand, and they have to listen. And it's really creepy and powerful watching, you know, as you said, Mike, who's pretty happy-go-lucky and just kind of rolls with the punches. Oh, the kid down the street is, you know, got their head stuck in the stairs, whatever. He crumbles. He crumbles that there's this thing that he can't control, that he can't solve.
Absolutely. And then when they collectively decide that they are going to just give away one of their children, which, first of all, Mike is so adamant about them trying to call his bluff and stand together. And they're like, no, we're just all going to stand against you, basically. And as soon as they do that, you know it's going to be Mike's kid.
Oh, yeah.
Who ends up being the chosen one, regardless of what anyone says about the rules or how fair it is, you know. And the fact that Ralphie's mom was the last one to pick out a rock, too. It's just like, okay, really? You know, you would think it would be somewhere, you know, second person, fifth person, something like that. But no, of course, because she picked last, she's the one who got it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and what I can't remember is, obviously the script was, unlike him writing a book, it was a script written for a miniseries. So a lot of it really did come through, you know, pretty verbatim from the screenplay.
Yeah. But
there were a couple of things that did get omitted. At times I was happy they did, because even in reading it in the description, I was just kind of like, I don't remember this in the miniseries, and this is kind of lame. But what I can't remember is, I know she's freaking out at him in both the miniseries and the book and saying, you know, this is fixed, you know, I don't agree to this. And he says, you made an agreement. But either in the book or in both, I know she says something like, you chose my son. You wanted him from the beginning. Because if you go back to the scene in the grocery, you know, he picked him up. What did they call the thing on his nose? The fairy saddle or something?
Yeah.
You know, he calls that out. He kisses him on the nose. He lures him into the closet. He gives Ralphie the stones. So, you know, it's, you know, whatever Leno says, you know, you're left to think, is he telling the truth? Was it a straight game? Was it fixed? Because on one hand, you're like, oh, he's super evil, he's a demon. But on the other hand, he's also kind of the only character in the entire thing who has told the truth in every single line. And all these, as he points out, all these other characters, they have dark secrets, and the town is full of people that aren't as good as they claim to be. It's twisted to watch it and kind of feel like the only person you can trust is the sadistic demon who wants to steal the child.
Plus, I feel like in 2020, you would not be able to have a man just lure this child everywhere and have it not be infinitely more creepy. You know, we kind of get a sense that Ralphie has this trust in Lenoge because he picks him up, like you said, and he's interacting with the kid in a more loving way, but pulling a kid into a closet, that's just one of those red flags where you're like, oh no, here we go. And I feel like the only reason it works in this is because of the fact that we do find out that Lenoge is a demon who is looking for a protege, and it's better if that protege is a child. Why it can't just be one of the other adults is never really made clear, but he's definitely going to have more power over one of the children. And I'm guessing that is why it's about the children and not anyone else in the town.
I feel like the easiest interpretation is that the child is young, innocent, and impressionable. And, you know, you look at, for instance, Ralphie, you know, he reacts to this guy that's in handcuffs and even later when they find him in the closet, that they, you know, he says, he's like, we were playing a game, you know, he's the man that daddy had arrested, but I don't think he's a bad man. Like, it's just, it's clear that the town that he's grown up in, you know, clearly, although maybe they should have, because there's some, unless Lenoge is lying, there's some absolutely terrible people in this town. But clearly it seems like they've never had to have the stranger danger conversation with yeah. Ralphie. And so anyone who's in this town, he can just kind of assume that he can trust, because everyone does seem to be like one big family. You know, the one character talks about how she largely raised her child by herself, mm-hmm. but really raised her child with the whole town. I feel like it has to do with the child is young, impressionable. Probably something about the innocent soul gives him more power and can live longer. And, you know, it's someone who's a teenager or more grown up may fight back a little more on what he wants to be done, or the teachings that he has, where he can just control the child and just go from there.
I will say that all of these little tidbits that Lenoge brings up really does seem to give us all of the various B plots for this miniseries, because as anyone who has read a Stephen King book knows, he does like to have these little side plots that aren't part of the main story necessarily, like how we learn that Katrina, known as Kat, had an abortion, and he just sort of announces that to the whole town, and especially her boyfriend, who did not know about it, who had been cheating on her anyway. So she was like, you know, you weren't going to be much of a father. And there's this whole B plot with the two of them going back and forth. And then he tries to get Bobby to kill Kat, but then Kat kills Bobby because Bobby's resisting too much. So he has this power to make people do things that they truly don't want to do, but because the thought has crossed their mind, it's kind of easier to manipulate them. And he just takes people too, when they foolishly go out in the middle of the storm to watch the lighthouse fall apart. I was just like,
I know.
Okay, you guys do that. And when you find out that it's whiteout conditions and then you get outside and you can still see everyone, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, yes, they had to film these scenes outside because they said they were going outside. But at the same time,
yeah,
being in Colorado now, I kind of know what whiteout conditions look like, and it wasn't exactly that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you do true whiteout conditions, I guess you'll just hear the characters, and, you know, that's not necessarily great television, I guess.
No, probably not.
But it is funny that it's kind of like, on one hand, you're like, oh my gosh, like, it's the town lighthouse, and it's almost like a weird excitement that they're excited to watch it happen. Because, you know, it's this tiny little town. Entertainment is probably very laid back or old school. So it's, you know, this is kind of just like, oh my gosh, like, this is a huge thing. Stuff like this doesn't happen. You know, we have to witness this and see what happens. Even though, you know, like you and I were sitting here and we're just like, horrible blizzard, giant structure collapsing. I'm probably going to suggest stay inside. But everyone was like, let's go, let's go.
Yeah, I feel like that was just a recipe for disaster as soon as they said, let's go outside. And, you know, it's fine because it is a TV miniseries. It is a Stephen King thing. So you have to have those characters who make bad decisions and don't necessarily give you what you're hoping for out of their personalities and things like that, because
horror in general, bad decisions.
Yeah. And you do kind of build up these ideas of what you want these characters to turn out like when you either start watching something or start reading something. And more often than not, Stephen King will try to find a way to subvert your expectations for better or worse. Yeah. And you really just, because of how many people are in this, never get a full sense of, okay, this character is definitely going to go in this direction and this character is definitely going to go in a different direction. You're just kind of like trying to keep track. And I think that was the main downside to this. It's like, I understand wanting to get that small town feel and everybody knows everybody, but when everybody knows everybody and the audience doesn't, it's kind of hard to keep track.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, it was you know, surprisingly a really great way to get all those B stories and everything, because it was just little quips of exposition that, you know, didn't feel like I was getting an exposition dump. It was just like, oh, that's a new thing about the character I didn't know. And now suddenly this feels like a real person and not just, you know, the person in the background that's like, oh, hey, Jim, it's nice to see you. It's like, oh, that's probably a nice person in the town. And then, but you get this little piece of information. But yeah, like if you were to ask me, you know, whose kid was whose, I have no idea.
Other than Ralphie, yeah.
You know, even there were a couple times that watching some kids started talking and I thought it was Ralphie. And then they showed me Ralphie. I'm like, oh, shit. I'm like, that's not Ralphie. I'm like, whose kid is this?
There was the annoying kid who was Robbie Beale's son.
Yeah, which I want to say that kid grew up to, like, that I've, like, seen that actor in a lot of stuff. Like, he had, like...
He's been in the Santa Claus movies.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay, yeah. The face was right there, and I was just like, I can see it, but they're definitely, like, younger.
Yeah, I had to look it up because I was like, I know this kid. And I was like, was he in a Nickelodeon show or something? And I had to go Google and figure it out because it was going to bother me if I didn't. But I agree. Yeah. It was one of those things where you're like, okay, here's a bunch of kids and we're only ever going to see two or three with their parents. So then it's going to be very confusing as to whose kid is whose. And I think Pippa, who was the girl who got her head stuck in the stairs, she was the daughter of... I want to say
Hatch.
Yes, that is what I was going to say too. And sadly, she grew up and died from an overdose by the time she was 21, I want to say.
Oh.
And it's one of those things where this has actually come up with multiple young actors who have been in Stephen King adaptations, obviously not because they were in Stephen King adaptations, but it's right. Just something that... is always so tragic when you hear about it. And I had no idea who she was. She did kind of look familiar. So then I was Googling her too. And I was like, oh man, you know, that was not what I expected to find. But you know,
yeah.
You have River Phoenix, Brad Renfro, her, and who knows how many others that I just didn't end up Googling or already know about.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrible. But yeah, I mean, I don't really have anything to add to, you know, that it is really tragic when you watch a number of these things and, you know, you kind of, you see the child actors and, you know, it's what we do. We inevitably go to IMDb and you look them up to see, it's like, oh, what did they go on to do? It's like, oh, they're familiar. Even if they're not familiar, you're kind of just curious. Like, did they grow up to be an actor that, like, I do know? And then you find out something like that and you're just like, yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
But I think the miniseries is very well-rounded, you know, overall. But I do agree with, as much as I feel like we do get a feel for the town, and by the end, I feel like, you know, especially with Mike and Molly, like, and a few of the other parents, we get to know them enough so that we can feel the emotion and feel the tragedy that they feel or the anger that they feel and be, like, moved by it. You know, we got enough of their background to get attached to the characters. But one of the things I thought about, you know, while I was watching was, you know, what if this was done, you know, now and it was done on, say, like, HBO and was, you know, 10 episodes and, you know, you get more time with the characters and maybe there's, you know, just some more character build and development of the town before maybe we start seeing the bad stuff on the side, you know, as the audience, but all the characters aren't affected by the bad stuff. So we're getting like our entertainment kind of from the bad stuff, but then we're waiting for, you know, say it's like episode four is usually the one that like people are like, oh man, episode four, like now I'm hooked, I can't stop. And I wondered that even though it's long, you know, would, if it were to be redone, and the fact that this was made from a screenplay into a miniseries, I don't necessarily know that they would redo it. You know, it's a little different than,
yeah, because it was made for TV already. It's not an adaptation, yeah, of one of his novels. He just wrote the screenplay. They made it, and then they also released it as, you know, a screenplay book. And I do agree with you, though, that maybe spending more time with the characters would have benefited, because they throw so much at you that even within the 4 or 4.5 hour period, you're kind of like, okay, I understand what happened, you know, and we do at least get the post-storm, which I want to talk about in a minute. But you get this sense that, okay, this town has secrets, this town has problems, and a lot of those things come to light throughout the 3 episodes, and then you're like, okay, but he's going to take one of the children, so now we have to focus on that, and everything else just sort of gets pushed to the side, and you're kind of left feeling like things are a little unresolved.
Yeah, like what if we got, you know, if more time with, say, Kat and Billy, mm-hmm. and we got a feel for their relationship, you know, because it was just kind of like watching that scene and them kind of arguing about it. It was all of a sudden, oh, they were a couple. Like, I didn't know they were a couple until really this moment. You know, even when Linoge makes kind of like a side comment to Billy, I didn't necessarily know, like, were they a couple or, you know.
Did he just knock her up? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, like it. So it's, I wondered, you know, it's, I feel like, as much as I don't know that they ever would redo it, I feel like it would be really cool if they would and did it on, you know, a streaming service or something, and we got an extended time with the town, get to know some of these people, maybe even the reveal of some of their secrets before Linoge, you know, really reveals it to other people, you know, and then, but even when he reveals it to other people, then our focus is on the reaction of the town. You know, it's like, oh, we knew that, but these people in the town didn't know it. I feel like that could have benefited in a number of instances, because as much as I feel like once Linoge is in the jail, the pacing and the focus works for the most part really, really well. But when I started watching it, I was slightly nervous in the very beginning, because I had very, very fond memories of watching this live. You know, granted, I'm not even going to do the math on how old I was in 1999, but I started to think, because the pacing, I don't want to say like necessarily the pacing was bad, because I don't necessarily know that it was pacing or it just, something felt awkward. Mm-hmm. Like it just, it almost felt like, you know, and I mentioned this about the screenplay, kind of that in some of the ways he described things, it almost felt like kind of a first draft, just throwaway description of something that he might go back and try again. It almost felt kind of like an assembly cut of sorts in say the first 15, 20 minutes, where I was kind of like, would they have like moved this around? Would they have trimmed this like a little bit? Like just something felt off in the timing. Yeah. And it felt a little awkward in the interactions with the characters. It didn't feel as natural. It didn't feel like the characters necessarily knew each other. It felt very acted. Not saying that later some things don't feel very, very acted. Not everybody is a true shine of of acting ability in this. But yeah, it just felt off and weird. But I was happy that, you know, once they kind of got him and they got him in jail, and I'd say probably especially after the next kind of magically done suicides, you know, the one guy hanging himself, the other guy horribly axing himself in the face.
Yeah, I was like, wow, that is the last thing I think a lot of people would choose to do as their method of suicide, because hanging yourself, that was one where you were like, okay, that is going to look like a suicide. And you have these scenes where you're kind of like, wow, Confior is just going all in for it. And I'm deeply sorry if I mispronounced his name there, because I'm horrible at pronouncing names. But he really was, I think, the standout performance, because he was creepy the whole time. He's just
so good.
Nice enough to the kids to where everything he did with the kids wasn't super creepy. And even though it was highly unacceptable, you're like, okay, clearly he knows how to get the kids to trust him and have all of the adults distrust him. So you had that push and pull with his character the entire time. And then after the storm, when Mike moves away, goes to San Francisco, he sees him with Ralphie. And the way they made him look was just so gross, really.
How they made Ralphie look, or how they made Linoge look, like him being older?
How they made Linoge look when he was like aging and all of this stuff. Oh, and you could see, you could just see him dying.
Yeah. It's almost like Crypt Keeper esque, like kind of borderline on that, you know, like creep show. Yeah. He is just unbelievable. And I mean, just the subtlety in every delivery of his line, just the pure calm in his voice. You know, he, from the start of, you know, when he, you know, rips away the walker and murders Martha, to sitting in the jail cell, and when he addresses the town, you know, just calmly saying, you know, I want one of your children, you know, it's just, he's so creepy. He's definitely among the Stephen King adaptations that I've seen, and even, you know, it's a screenplay, but books I've read, you know, even sitting and reading it, I was just blown away by this character. He's definitely one of my favorite Stephen King villains that he's written. And yeah, I mean, so to have him just have this kind of blank look in his younger self that just felt so sinister, yet it was done so simplistically, and then the reveal of how old and, you know, almost falling apart like he feels, and then, you know, in the end, like after the storm, you know, it's like a weird blend of the younger, like calm, sinister man that we had spent most of the miniseries with, and the creepy demon wizard that we got later. It was like this horrifying blend of like having him stand next to now older Ralphie, and like the fangs.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that has stuck with me since I was a kid. Like I remember that stuff vividly. I remember the, you know, even talking about it with my dad, like both of us were like, oh man, the red eyes, like it was so creepy. And we both for years have always remembered the ending. You know, it was just talking about it afterwards and being like, he sees his kid and then the kid smiles, but he's got fangs. Like, it's just like that. It was so awesome. I remember us being like hyped and horrified about it when we first saw it live. And I remember it, you know, just us talking about it, you know, earlier today when I told him I finished the miniseries, and I was like, oh man, when it got to the end scene, and he was like, yeah, he's like, that was really creepy. And now he wants to watch it with me. Like, I remember that just being a huge deal and a powerful moment, and so well done. And I was glad that even rewatching it now, like that creepiness delivered.
Yeah. And then you have the fact that Molly goes on and marries Hatch, because the two of them have both lost their spouses in one way or another. And you really just have this town that's rebuilding, and Mike just couldn't bear to look at any of them anymore. So he goes off and moves to the opposite side of the country, but still lives on the water. So he still kind of gets these same feelings every now and then. And I just really like how they wrapped it up. But I think overall for me, this was a 3 out of 5. It was good, but I think it was too long, and we had too many characters that we didn't know enough about that we were supposed to care about. Like with Ursula, you were kind of like feeling bad for her because her husband was killed, but then you don't really know a whole lot about her other than she kept in touch with Mike and was the one who was sending all the clippings, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I'm probably right there with you. I don't think I personally ever felt a feeling of this is too long. I was very much okay with the, especially once Linoge was arrested, like I was really into this, just the slow burn of things unfolding. I guess my complaint was I wanted more. Like you said, you know, Ursula, like being upset that like her husband's dead. I wanted kind of more of that fallout. I wanted more from the introduction of characters, and I wanted more from the fallout of all the characters. I wanted to experience all of their horror and dread a bit more. You know, we got a lot from Mike and Hatch and some of the main people's perspectives, but I guess, you know, it's hard to say, you know, back then when it aired, you know, kind of how things felt watching it then, but at least watching it now and knowing the ability of what modern miniseries can accomplish with these, you know, 8 to 10 hour long episodes, you know, that we watch on Netflix, Hulu, HBO, whatever.
I mean, Castle Rock's a great example too, because that just yes. takes the lore of Stephen King and focuses on this town that any Stephen King fan would know of, and you just get these totally new stories too. So I think if they were to do something, maybe they could do something like that, where it's like yeah. Little Tall Island, because you've had Storm of the Century take place there. That's where Dolores Claiborne took place, if I'm not mistaken. And it's something that has recurred in more than one of King's stories. So you can do different things instead of just remaking things, because I get the feeling we're going to have a ton of remakes coming our way. We already do. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah. Some of them are definitely due because, you know, they were, you know, miniseries from like the 70s and stuff. But I feel like this held up enough that, you know, hey, if they did a new series and it was awesome, I'd be excited. But I feel like it holds up enough that we don't really need a remake of it. But I really like that idea. Like, that's a perfect point of the style of Castle Rock is basically what I want out of this story. If I were to, you know, what I want out of the story in general, and what I want out of the story, you know, if I were to see it in done now in modern era, I want more from the characters. I want to get to know them and then be utterly crushed when Stephen King rips my heart out with it, you know.
As he does. I think that's a good place to wrap this up, though. So, Tim, thank you so much for coming on to talk about Storm of the Century today. I'm sure you will be back on relatively soon for something else.
Yeah, I have no idea, but I'm up for it. This was a good time, as always.
All right, that does it for this episode of Chat Cemetery. You can support the podcast on Patreon for $1 a month. You'll get a thank you on the show. For $2 a month, I will send you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And if you want to follow us on social media, you can do so at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You could also rate and review the show. That's a huge help. And as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.